The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Mike Coleman on WDB 860 AM, Philadelphia Talk Radio with the Middle East Forum Radio Hour. Joined by my co-host, Gary Gamble, and our producer, Marilyn Stern, over the airwaves, we have two guests today. The first, Shukriya Bradost Mahmoudi, part two, continuing our interview on the status of the Middle East Kurds in Syria, Turkey, Iran, and Iraq. And then join at the bottom half of the hour, from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and the European Foundation for Democracy, Anna Borshevskaya, speaking about Russia and the Middle East. But first, a little bit of the news. It's been a fascinating week so far in terms of what's been going on in the Middle East because we have seen a repeat of what happened last year, which started the Middle East hot summer of 2019. First, a massive attack against Saudi Arabia's capital, Riyadh, ostensibly by drones and long-range missiles being launched from Yemen by the Houthis, the rebel movement there fighting against the UN-backed government in Aden and having support from the Iranian government. And of course, it's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, and its overseas division, the Al-Quds Brigade. Now, as a result of this, it was the first time that any American embassy urged that American citizens in Saudi Arabia shelter in place. There has not been an order like this since the 1991 Gulf War, when Saddam Hussein was lobbing Scud missiles into Saudi Arabia's capital and onto U.S. bases across Saudi Arabia. That's what precipitated the American invasion of Kuwait and then into Iraq during that episode. Now, you might ask yourself, why has it been, and there was actually another smaller attack that took place in May, but why has it been almost a year since the Iranians urged a drone swarm and dozens of missiles being launched at the Saudi capital? We have to go back 13 months to understand some context. First, we had the attack on Saudi Arabia's main oil export facility in the west of the country, in the east of the country, take place in May last year. If you remember this, it shut off like 10 to 15% of global oil supplies because they were not able to get most of that refinery capacity taken out for weeks. It was considered a soft spot in Saudi Arabia's hydrocarbon resource infrastructure. Its ability to both drill, to then process the oil, and then to ship it out to destinations and ports across the world. Now, the second thing is that in the interim, about 6 months ago, after that major attack took place against Saudi facilities, the engineer of Iran's actions against moderate Sunni Arab states, against Israel, and against the American presence in the Middle East, Qasem Soleimani, was taken out by an American strike in Baghdad's international airport by a Predator RX-8 drone. Now, after the drone strike took place, we then had a period of, I would say, you know, besides a few tit-for-tat American strikes against Shia militias in Iraq that were responsible for attacks against American bases and diplomatic outposts across the country, and also for a little over-the-border action with the Americans striking the Syrian government, there wasn't really that big of a large or large of a response by the Iranians against the United States. There was that missile attack that took place from Iranian territory on American bases, but most people who were injured by that did suffer traumatic brain injuries, being concussed, but it was almost as if though the Iranians had warned the Americans prior to them launching that salvo of missiles in what was their, I guess, tepid response to the killing of Soleimani. Now, fast forward 6 months later, and the Iranians are at it again. The same downward spiral that took place, which led the United States to taking that strategic calculus, that decision to take out Soleimani in the end of last year, beginning of this year, started with an attack against a foreign ally's oil infrastructure. But this time, they have not struck resources. They have struck the beating heart of the nation of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia's been struck before. Riyadh, the capital, has been struck before, but not to the magnitude of what happened 24 hours ago. We have an American election coming up. We have the Saudis still trying to diversify their economy. We have them trying to comply with the OPEC Plus agreement with Russia. There is an ongoing purge of Saudi officials of the last generation associated with the current king being replaced by allies of the next generation being led by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. And then the Saudis in the middle of the night wake up to see the royal family, all the symbols of the Saudi kingdom under attack by Iranian-provided armaments being launched by Houthi rebels again. Most anti-missile infrastructure did not succeed in knocking these targets out of the sky. Most deterrents that the Saudis have adopted in the wake of trying to strike back at the Yemenis, at the Houthis, has not fared well because they keep on going. And an announcement that took place is reported by the Washington Post. This is the quote. The Saudi-led military coalition fighting in neighboring Yemen said it intercepted one ballistic missile targeting Riyadh, but there were no immediate responses to the claims that ministries and the airbase was hit. Targeting the defense and intelligence ministries as well as an airbase. If true, this strike would mark one of the largest attacks by the rebels on Saudi soil and their more than five-year war in Yemen. The episode threatens to further escalate the conflict in the Arab world's poorest nation, where humanitarian crisis is worsening. In a televised speech on Tuesday, the Houthi military spokesman claimed that a large number of ballistic and winged missiles and drones struck Saudi Arabia's defense ministry, intelligence ministry, and King Salman air base, as well as military positions in Jizan and Najran, two cities in southwestern Saudi Arabia near the Yemeni border. So let's offer the 60 seconds of analysis before we get to the final point here. The Saudi intervention in Yemen has been going on for 5 years. There have been cross-border retaliatory strikes by the Houthi rebels against Saudi installations, but nothing of this magnitude. What will the Saudis do? Because this message is not being launched against Riyadh from within Yemen. It is being telegraphed from Tehran and from Iran. And the idea that the Saudis have the wherewithal, the capacity, the fervor, the loyalty, the nationality, the patriotism to be able to strike back directly against Iran. Saudi does not have any militias, which are its proxy forces in Iraq or in Afghanistan or any other neighboring country of Iran. Except maybe Pakistan. But considering that Iran would be facing against a nuclear power, and the Pakistanis themselves have their own issues, I don't see them becoming quite online with the Saudis to strike back. Two, if the Saudis then decide that they cannot offer retaliation against Iran directly, and they figure they must do it within Yemen, what is left for them to do? The Houthis have become entrenched. They have declared self-rule. They are now months after a power sharing deal collapses between the Saudis and their back. The Emiratis have their own southern Yemeni faction that they back. And now the Iranians have them. So we've gone from a two-part civil war with Western actors in the Gulf Arab states backing the Sunnis in Yemen and the Iranians backing the Houthis. And we've gotten to a situation where we now have three, four, five sides that are fighting amongst themselves. And the Iranians, like they have for the past 40 years of being involved in promoting internecine warfare and picking the strong horse who may not necessarily become the sovereign in that country, but the perpetual underdog consistently able to undermine sovereign states' powers, has again picked the right side. And as much as the Saudi effort to intervene in Yemen has floundered over the past 5 years, it now looks like that floundering has cost them the price of being struck directly in their capital. We'll see what happens tomorrow, but my hopes and my aspirations for a quick end to this conflict go as fast as a Houthi missile blows up over the skies of Riyadh. After these messages, shukriya brodost.
The Israel Victory Project steers U.S. policy toward backing an Israel victory over the Palestinians to resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict. Decades of what insiders call peace processing have left matters worse than where they started. The time has come for a new approach, a complete rethinking of the problem that draws on Israel's earlier and successful strategy of deterrence. Stop pressuring Jerusalem to compromise and make painful concessions. Instead, support Israeli victory, convincing Palestinians and others that the Jewish state will endure. Read more at meforum.org.
This is a public service announcement test from TakeMeFishing.org to determine if you need a fishing license and boat registration before heading out on the water. Let's begin. Are you a bear? Do you have a beak? Does your name rhyme with Auld Beagle? Do you dart in front of cars? Here's a tough one. Do you have plumage? Do you rub your body against things to mark them? Do you have webbed feet? No, I mean like a... Were you hatched? Do you have fur? I'm not talking back hair. Does your boat fly south for the winter with the other boats? Regardless of how you answer, you need to be licensed and registered because it helps local conservation efforts protect the very natural resources you enjoy boating and fishing in for generations to come. Do your part at TakeMeFishing.org.
We are now joined by Shukriya Bradost. She recently wrote a chapter for a book titled State and Democracy about the nation state and democracy. Her latest research focuses on security and stability in the Middle East, and her academic knowledge, field experience, and fluency in five languages makes her a unique voice on international and Middle Eastern affairs. Currently studying for her PhD at Virginia Tech, she has an MA in international security from Leicester University, United Kingdom, and a BA in law from Saladin University in Erbil in Iraq. A native of Iran, Shukriya joins us again this morning after having first appeared on the show last week. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for having me again.
Of course. So last week, I think we were able to get through a brief overview of the Kurds in Iraq and in Iran, but we were only beginning our conversation about the Kurdish presence in Turkey and the Kurdish presence in Syria. To refresh our listeners' memory, can you please give us an overview of what is the intra-Kurdish rivalry in Iraq between the Talabani and the Barzani families, and where this comes from, and how Middle Eastern states take advantage of that?
Yeah, for sure. Actually, because this part of the Kurdish territory, Kurdistan region government, the only part in the Middle East that Kurds have an autonomy right, and these two political parties, their main political party in that part of the Kurdistan, that they've been fighting against the Baghdad regime for a long time. And then these both parties in their history, they got help from Iranian government, for the Turkish government to fight against Baghdad, because as I said previous program, the Kurds always trying to get support from the outside of the Iraq, outside the border, because they're not strong enough to fight their own war. So it is the reason when they help them, and they always asking them for a favor. And since you are not trusting your central government like the Baghdad, even after 2003, you always are in need from the supporting from that countries like Iran and Turkey. So in this case, each country is trying to involve the Kurdish domestic policy in the KRG, and they're trying to shape this policy in their own favor. And in this case, you can see the PUK are more close to the Iran, and the KDP, we can say more close to Turkey. But in the KDP case, it's different because Turkey has a more economic and the border for the business and even sending KRG's oil to the European. So you can see the KDP always, when they're talking about their relation with the Turkey, they say Turkey is the only option we have to actually send our oil outside of Iraqi border. And even sometimes after the 2013, when the first time KRG sent the oil outside of Iraq, the Turkey's and relation with the Iraq was in the kind of in the it was gloomy because of that. Helping KRG to send the oil for Turkey was a as a negative point against Baghdad. But you know, Turkey was having his own comment and his own interest to helping Kurds and in that specific topic in selling the KRG's oil. Because now we have a problem that Turkey's like, after they selling the KRG's oil, they keeping this money in their bank, we call it the Halk Bank, and this money is not given to KRG's easily. And sometimes even they release this money as a kind of a loan. So I don't want to go that much deep in this difference between these two groups, but I wanted to just say it is the reason you have a PUK and KDP's rivalry inside Kurdistan. And for sure, when you have two political parties, you have a competition to take over of the power. Each party, they're trying to play their own card.
So how can we get the Kurds to work together, cognizant of the fact that they're often taken advantage of by these different governments?
In this case, you have to have support from the outside of these four countries, Iran, Turkey, Syria, and Iraq, who has a Kurdish population and been controlled Kurdish land for a long time in history. So you need the Western country, you need the American support. Even like America's support for the Turkey and Iran during the history, it is the point that I want to mention that point now, because the support of American for the most of this country push Kurd or encourage them to be more, sometimes in Turkey, to become the leftist group in this country. Because when you have a support for the Kurdish enemy, so you're encouraging them or you push them to go to the different side. But in the different side, it is left in Turkey. This left group never got the support from the leftist countries like China or Russia too. But I mean, the only way you can make Kurds unite is the support they cause with outside of the region's supporter.
So the only way that we'll ever see an independent Kurdish entity is if a country like the United States steps in. That's your hypothesis?
First of all, I do believe like it depends on the own people too, like the people's uprising, not just Kurds. And the Iranian people or Turkish people, Iraqi people, is dependent on the people's support for the human rights and self-determination of these ethnic groups. We have to work on that first. We have to try to convince these people, this population, Persian population, Turkish population, Arab, that the other ethnic group that living with you during this history, they peacefully, try to live with you, but always do you attack them. So first, we have to work in their own each countries to with the population. And if I do believe like, most of the time, the domestic policy or domestic change is not helping some ethnic group like Kurds to be independent or to achieve their goal. And sometimes you need outside support too, in the case of the military, exactly.
See, this is my thought, and I'd like you to respond to this. Some 97-98% of the Kurdish public in Northern Iraq and the three provinces which are ran by the Kurdish regional government all supported the independence referendum. But there's one thing about voting for independence, and then another when your sectarian political party, whether the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan or the Kurdish Democratic Party, whether your clan, the Barzanis or the Talibanis, gives you the order when you have the opportunity to defend your territory, like they were supposed to have done in Kirkuk and in Tikrit, and half of your Peshmerga brethren withdraw from their posts, leaving your Kurdish cousins to be slaughtered by Shia militias. There's something here that's more than just influenced by the Iranians or influenced by the Turks or saying no to Baghdad. I think that there's something deeper in Kurdish animus against one another, that even if a country like the United States supported Kurdish independence, there would be a much higher bar to deal with of intra-Kurdish reconciliation before anyone would actually be able to declare an independent state. And that's just within Iraq. What's the guarantee that the Maoists in Syria, the socialists and the communists in Turkey, the smugglers and the, I don't want to call them monarchists, but the separatists in Iran and the kleptocrats and, on the other hand, Democrats or liberal Democrats in Iraq will all be able to work together? How do we get past those challenging bars?
Yeah, actually, you mentioned the Kirkuk case. Kirkuk case was is important to mention. This different between PUG and KDP was obvious in that province. And in the Kirkuk case, it wasn't even PUK, because PUK being divided among a few, I can't say their leaders or the member of the Beria, PUK's Beria. So it was the 5 persons, even they released the agreement with the Baghdad government, they released the agreement with the Iranian, with the Qasem Soleimani, that how they're going to push Peshmerga away, out of the Kirkuk. And in that case, to give you detailed information about what happened that day in Kirkuk, so the Peshmerga, they could actually fight in Kirkuk, but the problem was, you had a Kurdish other side, there are Kurdish forces that been supported by Baghdad and Iran. And if you want to go fight with that Kurds, it means starting the second civil war in the Iraqi Kurdistan, that Barzani didn't want to go through the second civil war. He decided to withdraw from Kirkuk. It was the main point for Peshmerga for withdrawing, because a small group of the PUK's leadership, they decided to get side with the Baghdad and Iran, as I said, because they own interest. Iran was, they promised them some benefit, and they promised them even they're going to attack Erbil too. As you remember, they forced came close to the to Erbil.
If we could focus on this for a second, this is the problem that I'm talking about. The Kurds had the ability to declare independence. The U.S. was seeing what was going to happen. And then a fight within the Kurdish body politic led the entire drive to collapse. They chose Iran over their own brothers. How can a further independence referendum guarantee that that won't happen again?
When you have a support for that referendum and with that independent, because after referendum, we have to remember that U.S. didn't support that referendum in first place. And after even the result, that 97% of the people, they voted for yes, the U.S. and Western country, none of them, they supported that referendum. I do remember when the first time the Kurds decided even to do that referendum, Turkey, who are extremely against the Kurdish independence in Iraq, in the first place, they told, okay, it is Iraqians' decision, they can do it, and it is Iraqi citizen. They look at the Kurds as Iraqi citizen. But after that, when Turkey found the green light from the Western country, they found that none of the Western countries supporting this independence, so they took a side with Iran and standing strongly against the referendum and independent Kurdistan. And in this case, when you have this kind of the scenario is going on in the region, so you as a small group that you have a rivalry about against who are controlling most of power in the KRG, for sure you will find the support from these neighbors that Iran they offer this support for the PUK's small group. I'm not saying that PUK, I'm some small group within PUK, they got support for Iran, because it is like the deep issues going on in the KRG, in the PUK, because PUK's leader, Jalal Talabani, who was in the president of Iraq, during his time, this small group didn't have any power in that political party. After his death, after Jalal Talabani's death, so this small group, it was Jalal Talabani's nephew, they trying to come to the power, and because they couldn't pass this old leadership, the strong leadership in that PUK, so they got the Iranian support, these young leaders, they got the Iranian support to take a power. So when you talk in this topic, you have to go to know the detail of why it happened, why this small group of the PUK accepted the Iranian offer and took the Iranian side.
Right, but what I'm saying is that so long as there is a minority of Kurds who are willing to sell their national interest for a sectarian or intra-sectarian gain by being bought off by the Turks or the Iranians or the Iraqis, it makes Kurdish independence that much farther away. The other item is if there's this idea that the Kurds are waiting for a force like the United States to back their drive for independence, the history of the United States stabbing the Kurds in the back is pretty out there and very public. It starts with Kissinger in the 70s. It then goes to the failure for Reagan to support the Kurds in the 80s, including a few massacres. It extends to George Bush refusing to march on Baghdad in 91. It then goes into the Clinton era when there's massacres of Kurds by the Baghdad government. And while the no-fly zone and the demilitarized zone is put in place in northern Iraq, the Kurds still don't have most of the support. And then after 17 years of the American, or at that time, 14 years of the American presence in Iraq, the Kurds helping take out Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and leading the efforts to help America eject Syrian and ISIS first from Iraq and then in the Battle of Mosul, and then further in the Battle of Raqqa in Syria, the U.S. pulls out. Why do you think the Kurds still believe the Americans will come and save the day?
Actually, you're right. Like for Kurds to trust in America, I cannot say it's 100% they trust in America because of, as you explained, and what happened in history and in the modern history, even like just was in the January, before January, what happened in the northeast of the Syria and the Rojava, the U.S. less Kurdish forces that they fought against ISIS together. But I mean, I want to add this point here. When we're talking about the Kurds and how they can get support from America, I was listening to your argument about the what's going on in Iran and Houthi in Yemen against Saudi. So if you just go back in the same argument you had about the Iranians and indirectly attacking Saudi by Houthis rebellions or Houthi groups in the Yemen, you will see why Iran is doing that. The Iran and Turkey nowadays, I mean, it's ongoing process. They're attacking Kurds in Iraq and in Iran, in both border of Iraq and the Turkeys. So why are they doing that? Why Iran is now they both attacking Kurds? Because if you look at the Iran's power getting decreased in the region. Iran's because of maximum pressure of the Trump administration first, and second because of Russia doesn't want Iran in the Syria and Israel attacking IRGC's bases in the Syria. So Iran's and most of the Iraqi now, the Iran lost popularity in Iraq too. So Iran lost Syria, they're going to lose Iraq. They don't have any power in the region like before because of this maximum pressure on Iran. And the second, because of the Iraq's economy is damaged too because of decreasing the oil price. Iraq cannot provide the money to the Shia militia groups in the region because Iran always, they try to use the Iraqi budget to support this Shia militia in the region too. Now they don't have that kind of the source for the supporting the Shia militia, Hamas and the Hezbollah and other Shia militia in the region. So what they do, they're trying to, at the end of the day, power, they're trying to show they're still strong. To showing that power, who they're attacking the most weak group, they are Kurds. So it is the reason Iran now, they're trying to attack Kurds in the Iraq and their own border and the Turkish border. And at the same time, they're trying to use Houthi to attack Saudi. So these are the only action that Iran can do now. And if you look at the Turkey has we're talking about the Turkeys in Libya, Turkey in Syria. In Syria, I do believe like Turkey stuck there because they don't know what to do. They in the Idlib, they don't want to do, they're going to have agreement with the Russia, but they have to withdraw that. And inside of the Turkey, you have a opposition that's growing every day. And even now, Erdogan's trying to have to change election law because they don't want to let the new opposition party to win this election, the future election in the Turkey. So what they do, they're trying to get the public support for the mistake in the foreign policy. They're trying to attack Kurds because of domestic policies, the radical nationalism in Turkey. They're supporting this attack. So you can see Kurds become one of the reasons that this both country, even the history of the Ottoman Empire and Persian Empire, they use Kurds for their own benefit. So in this case, where is the U.S. support for the Kurds? You can see, unfortunately, most of the time in the history, U.S. supported Turkey or Iranian monarch those days. So in this case, when you are look at in the like super like a powerful country like the U.S., they're trying to choose the strong ally, which is Turkey for now, because they do believe, I mean, I'm not supporting this policy in this case. They do believe supporting Turkey is helping them to stand against Iran, which I do believe is wrong, because you're letting Turkey to become another rogue state in the region. Iran already is going to be weak after this old pressure. And as I explained it, this is the way Iran is going to weak, reducing this power. But you trying to give Turkey more power and Erdogan more power in the region, that you will face a new threat in this region by not supporting Kurds in the cause or in the struggle with Turkey.
Okay, so we didn't even get to touch on Syria too much besides the Idlib issue and some of these other things. But we've got a minute or two left. With all these problems, okay, let's ask you for your ideal. And I mean, you grew up with this. You start off in Iran. You make your way to Iraq. You speak all the languages of the region. You do your PhD now in this. If we were to, you know, if the president of the United States was to come to you and say, Shukriya, I need a solution for how we get an independent Kurdistan, what would you tell him or her?
I will tell them in the first place, you need to have a federal system for Kurds in each of these countries, for Turkey, Syria, and Iran. In Iraq, we already have that federal system. I do believe in the first state, we need the federal Kurdistan in each of these parts. And if these countries, they can handle this federal system and work with the Kurds, I do believe Kurds, they want to have a democratic system in each of these countries. And in this case, we don't ask him for separating any other countries and create great Kurdistan that we always talking about it. We always say if they can give us as a human right, I mean, as a equal system in this country, why not? We can live with them. But if they cannot, if you will never see any democratic system or federal system in Syria and Turkey and Iran. So it is the reason Kurds for asking. They will ask for the independent Kurdistan in these countries. But first of all, for example, U.S. policy regarding Iran, they never talking about the federal system because they don't want to go with the ethnic groups problem. But it is reality that you cannot ignore it or deny it. Same problem that we have in Iraq. It started because they didn't have enough information about the ethnic groups in Iraq, and they didn't want to talk about this topic. So if you don't put this old topic on table when you're talking about the future of some countries like Syria, Turkey, Iraq, and Iran, you cannot have a clear plan for the future of these countries. If any change happens in these countries, mostly for Iran, though nowadays we're talking about.
Shukriya Berdoz from Virginia Tech. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Next, Anna Wyrzhevskaya, after these messages.
The Middle East Forum has been promoting American interests in the Middle East for the past 25 years. The Forum provides context, insights, and policy recommendations through its premier and most widely read Middle East journal, Middle East Quarterly, publishing debates, public lectures, staff writings, arguments, and coverage of every Middle Eastern country that America operates in. From Morocco to Iran, from Turkey to Djibouti, the Middle East Quarterly is there for you. Read more at www.mequarterly.org.
Take a look under your bed. find stuff under there? What about jobs? No? Now try your basement. There's a pair of overalls that, overall, you're not so into anymore. A perfectly good laptop that hasn't seen your lap in months. And even more stuff. But still no jobs? Well, you really have both. See, stuff is defined as household articles considered as a group. Sometimes this stuff is no longer needed. Wait, no longer needed? That can't be right. Because remember those jobs you were looking for? Those are really needed. And they're the stuff inside your stuff. Even inside that winter coat that moved with you to Phoenix. Our job is to unlock those jobs. And it starts when you donate your stuff to your local Goodwill. Here's how we do it. When you donate to Goodwill, we sell your stuff to provide job training for people right here in your community. So just by teaming up with Goodwill, you help create jobs. And isn't that worth parting with the leftover keytar from your 80s cover band? Goodwill. Donate stuff, create jobs. Find your nearest donation center at goodwill.org. A message from Goodwill and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Middle East Forum Radio here on WWDB 860 AM, Philadelphia Talk Radio. I'm Greg Roman, your host, and we have Marilyn Stern, our producer, and Garrett Gambler, our co-host, who are providing commentary by way of the internet. We are proud to have Anna Wyshevskaya, senior fellow at the Washington Institute, and also a fellow at the European Institute for Democracy, joining us at the bottom half of the hour. Anna, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
And I understand that you are somewhere in an undisclosed region of Virginia joining us this morning.
That is correct. So I apologize if the internet cell phone connection goes in and out a little bit, but so far I hear you very well.
All right, wonderful. And you have just published, a little over a week ago, a new analysis from the Washington Institute's Policy Analysis, Policy Watch, section number 3334. Russia's military activity in the East Mediterranean echoes its approach to Syria. So with a little bit of background, can you tell us about how Russia started its base in Tartus and in the Latakia province some 45, 50 years ago under the previous Assad, and then now how it's renewed that port? It has attempted to expand its influence in Libya, and it's sort of creating a flanking maneuver against NATO's interests in the Eastern Med, and why it's doing it and what its next steps are. Can you give us a general overview?
So, sure. So very briefly, in broad strokes, historically, the Russian state has always had an interest in the Eastern Mediterranean, even before the Soviet Union. And certainly the Soviet Union, as you say, was in particular interested in this region because this is NATO's southern flank. This is what the Russians historically called Russia's soft underbelly, but also a relatively weaker position for NATO. So Hafez al-Assad, Assad's father, had emerged as the closest Arab ally of the Soviet Union. And the Russians had established the base in Tartus that you had mentioned. It's actually more of a facility than really a full-fledged base at the time. With Russia's military intervention in 2015, Russia not only reinforced its presence in Tartus, but also created an air base in Khmeinim, and has subsequently looked for other ways to boost its military presence in Syria on the Eastern Mediterranean. What we're seeing now is Russia has been using Syria as a springboard for further expansion. And when it comes to Libya, Russia has multiple interests to go into it in more detail, but in short, access to the Eastern Mediterranean and checking NATO's southern flank is an important component of these priorities that Russia has.
Okay, so let's go over a list of these priorities. There's energy, there's strategic parity and strategic depth against NATO's forces there, there's the inability for Russia to get beyond the Bosphorus, and there's the desire to have a position to agitate against the U.S. on a western flank. It's not just the southern flank. It's also the U.S. Mm-hmm. being boxed in and creating a buffer between the Russian forces that are docked in Syria, a potential dock in Haftar's Libya, and then the U.S. Mm-hmm. having its own forces in Italy and in Cyprus, and also Crete to a certain extent in Greece. Can you give us more
That's
of a,
right.
a, a policy by policy analysis of where Russia hopes to gain an advantage against the U.S. and NATO?
So one chief priority, and this is more of a long game, is exactly as you said, basing access, checking NATO's southern flank, and looking for ways to outmaneuver the United States, more broadly Western allies. Libya provides a useful position for this for multiple reasons. For one thing, Russia's, together with Tartus, having more basing rights in Libya. Some analysts call Libya's ports deep water ports. In other words, it provides additional advantages that Tartus does not have. Having the advantage of using refugees. This has been another issue in the last several years with regard to Libya, in particular, using the refugee issue to pressure Europeans. Energy issues, as you said, are incredibly important. Libya has Libya's east, in particular, where Haftar has control, has enormous energy reserves. Syria's energy reserves are fairly minuscule. They matter more for their geostrategic location than for their quantity. But Libya's energy resources are very Now, what's happening in terms of Russia's other bigger play? Russia has been looking to position itself as "quote unquote" peacemaker, and this is a little bit different from Syria, where in Syria Moscow had clearly taken a side with regard to Assad. In Libya, Moscow has certainly been closer to Haftar. But they haven't been wedded to Haftar in the same way. In fact, Russia has built connections with everybody on the ground, including with the Sarraj government. And I would argue that Russia's interest in Libya, and this is a little bit different from Syria, is, for one thing, again, they're not wedded to Haftar to the same extent, and certainly he's probably a problematic actor, but in terms of the bigger interest, it's also fomenting instability. Because unlike in Syria, in Libya, the existing internationally recognized government did not invite Russia. So Russia has more of an interest in keeping a low-level conflict, basically a frozen conflict type scenario that we see in Russia's periphery, because that gives Russia a foothold. It gives Russia time to build up its presence. It also, everybody needs Russia in a situation like that. Everybody's looking to Russia as quote-unquote manager of a conflict. But managing a conflict is very different from resolving it. So Russia here has a specific interest in maintaining instability despite all talk about peacemaking efforts. And this is another big picture issue when it comes to Libya.
Right. And what about some of the other countries that we haven't addressed? For instance, Russia's increased military sales to Egypt, its interest mm-hmm. in the Gulf of Yemen, its participation in anti-piracy missions off the coast of Somalia. The Eastern Mediterranean and the Suez is a gate to Russian interests that may abut both those of America, the European Union, and China in the southern Red Sea.
That's right. And what's interesting, Russia has been for years, I guess let me start with saying that Russia for years has been working to build a good relationship with Egypt. Precisely because Russia understands the geostrategic importance of this country, because there's also a historic relationship with Egypt that goes back to the Soviet Union. And for a whole host of these other geostrategic reasons, Russia has worked very hard and also made headways with regard to building a closer relationship with Egypt. The current Egypt is, it's not that they've switched camps, but it is an Egypt that leans a little bit more to the Russian side. And what you're seeing is with regard to Libya is background. Russia, Libya has turned into a proxy battle for all these different actors, from Egypt, Turkey, for UAE. In effect,
okay, Anna, we have a little bit of hard time hearing you. Maybe try to get to a place where your reception is just a little bit better, perhaps closer to a window or somewhere near a door. Would that be okay? Okay, we may have lost her. We're going to have our engineer call back in. We'll go to a quick message. We'll be right back.
The Middle East Forum promotes American interests in the Middle East and protects Western values from Middle Eastern threats. The Forum sees the region, with its profusion of dictatorships, radical ideologies, existential conflicts, and weapons of mass destruction, as a major source of problems for the United States. Accordingly, we urge bold measures to protect Americans and their allies. Read more at www.meforum.org or check us out on Twitter at MEForum. The Middle East Forum, protecting your interests.
During the Civil War, it was called Soldier's Heart. After World War II, they called it Gross Stress Reaction. It's been called Shell Shock, War Neurosis, and Battle Fatigue. Today, we call it Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, and it affects one out of every five warriors returning from battle in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's not a wound that you can see, though it can have an even more significant impact. Post-traumatic stress disorder can prevent warriors from living a normal life, hurt their relationships, and affect their ability to hold a steady job. The Wounded Warrior Project offers comfort and support for warriors with post-traumatic stress disorder and all other scars of war, whether those scars are visible or hidden. Find out what you can do to help, because for warriors, the greatest casualty is being forgotten. Please visit WoundedWarriorProject.org.
Women Heart is in a race to save lives. Heart disease is the number one killer of women. It's 80% preventable, if you know the facts. Millions of women are living with or at risk of different types of heart disease, like AFib, which is a type of irregular heartbeat. It affects both women and men, but women with AFib have a higher risk of stroke and death than men. Get educated. See your doctor. Know the facts. Diet and exercise are key to staying healthy. Know the risks. Women Heart does something really unique, solely focusing on women and providing peer-to-peer support. To win this race, we all have to do it together. Our hearts beat as one. To learn more, visit womenheart.org.
DB 860 AM. Having some difficulties, technical difficulties this morning with our call with Anna from the Washington Institute, but we will be joined shortly by Winfield Myers, the director of Campus Watch, talking about a new initiative with Congressman Doug Lamborn, who has reached out regarding the University of California at Berkeley and its efforts by Congress to investigate its Middle East Studies Department for a few reasons. Number one, this has typically been a bastion of not just anti-Zionism, but also anti-Semitism, a publicly funded, a federally funded state university, which has had monies granted to it by the federal government to diversify its programs for teaching Arabic, for educating individuals about the Middle East by sending them abroad, and by exposing Americans to foreign cultures. And it's been doing it through a political lens rather through one of just solely needing to be academic. More than that, there's also the cultural side that has to be looked at. And Winfield will be telling us about this initiative. It's actually the fourth letter that Campus Watch and the Middle East Forum's Washington Project has generated in the past year. We've also covered the University of Arizona. That was Congressman Paul Gosar. The Georgetown University, which was done by Congressman Denver Riggleman, who unfortunately lost his primary a few weeks ago, but he's still in Congress for another 6 months or so, and he'll be focused on that. And one more, but with us focusing very much so on the basic elements of us trying to, I think, focus on higher education and also the Middle East studies profession and its reform. Now, we've been at this effort for the better part of 10 years. I'd even say 12 years since Title VI reform became a priority of the Middle East Forum. And Winfield will give us the update on that. He's been working with Cliff Smith, the director of the Washington Project, on this. And I would try to get Cliff on, but maybe we'll have him on next week instead. As we try to get Winfield on, there's been a few new hires at the Middle East Forum. We have Abdullah Bozkurt, who has joined us, the director of the Stockholm Center for Freedom from Norway, from Sweden, who has been joining us. We also have a new fellow from Israel, Amatzia Baram, who focuses on Iraq. And we're also looking to add those from the Libya, Algeria, and the Morocco fields, and that'll be an announcement that we make in the next few weeks. Anna has actually returned to finish up our interview on Russia and the Middle East. Anna, we lost you when we were talking about the segmentation of Russia's interests in Libya, how it's become a proxy battleground for Turkey, the UAE, Egypt, Russia, the United States, even Italy and France to a certain extent. But I wanted to focus a little bit farther east. Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco. Does Russia have designs to influence those countries?
It does. It absolutely does. And I mean, look, Algeria, frankly, I think of all these countries, I would argue never really fully left the Russian camp. With regard to Tunisia and Morocco, it's certainly a more complicated story. But Russia has been working through a number of channels to increase influence. And I'll give a few examples. With Tunisia, several years ago, when Russian tourists could no longer go to Turkey and Egypt after an embargo that Putin had placed on Turkey, and after a Russian plane was attacked, there was a terrorist attack on a Russian plane from leaving the Sinai. A very large number of Russian tourists had gone into Tunisia. And in fact, when I traveled to Tunisia several years ago, if you walked through the shops in the city center, in the capital center, Tunisian shopkeepers spoke Russian. With Morocco as well, the Moroccan king had traveled to Moscow several years ago. This was a very important visit. I had also seen some indications that the Russians are trying to encourage tourism with Morocco. So again, these are smaller steps, and this is not to say that we need to get overly, I guess, hysterical. It's not as if the Russians are coming, but certainly Russia is interested in building ties with these countries at the expense of the United States, and they do what they can based on context, and certainly context in Tunisia, Algeria, and Morocco are different. And I should add, of course, energy and arms trade, traditional Russian tools are very important for the relationship with Algeria as well.
There's also been deconfliction mechanisms set up between Russia and Israel. Can you elaborate on that?
Absolutely. So when Russia entered the Syrian theater, the Syrian military theater in 2015, it very quickly gained control of Syrian airspace through setting up what's referred to in the military as the anti-adversarial denial system, A2AD. Essentially, in short, it means denying your adversary freedom of action, and Russia has control of this airspace. So for Israel, the importance for Israel is being able to continue to strike Iranian-backed targets in Syria. It was very important not to have clashes with Russia, for not just for the United States, but also for Israel. More or less, this mechanism worked. But the fact of the matter is Russia controls Syrian airspace, and not the other way around. And there was a major incident that you probably recall when a little over a year ago, Assad has shut down a Russian plane, and Russia blamed Israel for this incident. Since then, it seems to have smoothed over, but it certainly showed you what can happen, how precarious the situation is.
Now, at the end of your piece, you make the policy recommendation that the United States do everything it can to stop private military contractors using force if necessary to be able to tamper or eject Russian influence from Libya. And I expect that you would also make similar recommendations, maybe not using force per se, to curtail its influence on Egypt and some of these other countries we've spoken about. Can you elaborate on that recommendation and how the U.S. would go about executing it?
Sure. And I apologize. I missed part of your questions. You cut off a little bit. It's my poor connection. But I think if I understood, you were asking me to elaborate on Russian PMCs and how the United States could boost its position. What I was trying to say is two things. Russia has been using a lot of covert activity in Libya through PMCs, in part because it's in a more difficult position. Also because PMCs have proven to be a useful tool, but Libya is not Syria for a number of reasons. And it's more challenging for Russia, and they've discovered that, especially with the Turkey's offensive in recent weeks. So PMCs are going to continue to be a useful tool for the Kremlin. You know, one thing I was about when I was writing the piece is, look, there was an incident with Syria in Deir ez-Zor with Russian PMCs where after repeated American warnings, they continued breaking an international agreement and continued with an offensive, and eventually the United States had no choice but to push back militarily and shoot at these PMCs, these quote unquote contractors. Again, it happened during the process, and it was in self-defense. My point was that sometimes you have to use force if necessary in situations like that, and the United States was justified, and I can foresee potentially a similar situation in Libya. And certainly, if anybody is worried about a full-scale war breaking out between the United States and Russia because of these incidents, it did not happen in Syria. In fact, the Russian government went to great lengths to at first deny that this happened and then minimize the impact. The other issue is simply the issue of legality and invitation, because again, in Syria, Russia repeatedly says that they've been invited by quote-unquote legitimate government of Assad. Well, there hasn't been the same invitation in Libya. So there's also an issue of just how legal are these activities of Russian PMCs.
Anna, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Sorry about the connection, but we look forward to having you back on air.
My pleasure, and look forward to being back.
For more information, go to the Washington Institute's website. We'll have it on the MEF website with the summary. But thank everyone for joining us today, and have a great week here for Middle East Forum Radio. This is Greg Roman on WWDB 860 AM signing off.